So I'll say this. I hope this sermon is twice as good as normal because I wrote it twice. You want to know the story? Okay. What are you going to say? No, we don't want to know the story. So typically, in prepping a message, it takes anywhere between 8 and 12 hours to prep a message, at least just for me. So it represents almost a quarter of what I do every week. And it's important to me, actually. You know why? This is the main discipling piece that I have with you every week. As we've said before here at Crossroads, if we do nothing else but meet for worship as people who are sons and daughters of the King, then we've done a profoundly important thing. And important enough that we need to keep doing it. Here's why. Because there's a time coming, and I think it's already coming, in our nation when we are not doing this like we used to. So I take it seriously, and I'm grateful you show up, and I owe it to you to give you my best. So 8 to 12 hours of punching away, trying to figure out, talking to Jesus, what do you want me to say? Here's what I think you want me to say. And it's like that it's a long wrestling match. So typically I have 8 to 10 pages of notes, and then I take that, I copy it fully, and I paste it into a new document, and that is where I end up producing the slides and the notes that you have in your bulletin. It's a skeleton. It's bullet points of what we're going to talk about. Guess what I forgot to do on Friday morning? I forgot to copy and paste into a new document. So I ended up taking the full teaching and narrowing it down to like the points you have in your bulletin, saved it, and I went, oh boy, gone. So I hope this is, even if it isn't twice as good as normal, what I need from you is to tell me at the end, that was twice as good as normal. And almost kind of mean it, truthfully. That'd be helpful. So we're on the move next week. That's really crucial. We'll have signage at the front. Tell folks you might run into. We'll email you. We'll maybe even Facebook you, because yes, I'm on Facebook. We are going to be at Vetter Middle School. It is on South Sumas. It's not too far from here, actually, at all. It's in the same neighborhood, more or less. 10:30 as usual. There will be summer kids zone. There will be in the big gym for worship. Then there's a mini gym just across the hall. And around the corner, in one of the rooms, actually, if you're who's a Vetter Middle School graduate here? Vetter Middle School graduate. Okay, so we're going to be in Mrs. Fern's room. What'd you put her? What, Ms. Vern? Yeah. What? What are you doing there? Okay. Summer Kids Zone will start next week as well. And by that, all we mean is this. We're going to keep the kids in for all of the music. Usually we have a worship package at the start, and then we share a few announcements and pray and let our kids go, and then we have another worship package. Well, for the summer, we're going to keep them in for all the music pieces and then dismiss them at the end for around a half an hour teaching. In that half-hour teaching, there'll be a nursery. There'll also be the kids K to 6 in the mini gym, where they'll have a snack, where they'll have gym time, and they'll have some teaching. Next week, I should tell you, next week actually, you got to come back because we're opening up the freezies again. We're going to have freezies for everyone that comes next week. And I'm told actually that gym is much cooler than this gym. Which stands to reason, and that one particularly. This one's not so bad. There's so much ambient light and heat in that particular gym. That's a cooker, right? There are no windows to the exterior in our gym at VMS, so it should be much cooler. Last thing I'll say, just by way of saying what I need to say before I say what I'm going to say. We'll be starting our summer teaching series, too, next week, July 3rd. And it's called Faith Builders. It's going to be 10 weeks long. I'll be teaching 7 out of those 10 weeks, and it'll cover topics like answered prayer. So this is different than spiritual disciplines. This is more like an encouragement piece in your life, and this is what it looks like, how to have faith when you're going through a tough time, learning from doubt. And I should tell you that the last 3 Sundays in August, we will have Pastor Doug Epcom, who is amongst us even this morning. We'll have Corey Bittner speak as well, and then we will wrap up August with Ray Cymbaluk speaking. So thanks to all those guys for being willing to do that. Thanks for our helpers who will be teaching. And while I'm thanking people, I'd like to invite you to help me thank a whole pile of people this morning. It's sort of timely because we're on the move. It's sort of in the spirit of who's been to a couple of assemblies this week at schools, like, okay, can I get one more 1.5 hour long assembly or graduation or whatever kind of thing? We've all been there this week in that spirit. So from start to finish, set up, what it takes to do on a Sunday morning here. And I've missed someone even. That's funny. I'll have to write that in or I'll forget it again. So they are as follows. And please stand if you are a member of one of these teams, but hold your applause, everyone else, your thunderous applause until the end. And by applauding, we mean we are grateful for you. So our setup crews, anybody who is a captain or who is a setup crew team member, please stand now. And stay standing, please. Set up crews, don't be shy. Get up, get up. Oh, yeah, let's go. That's right. Good. Our audio techs, so people who run the sound. James, please stand. There's others amongst. Don't stand, no. Oh, yeah, now. Yeah. Anybody who does visual, so easy worship, stuff like that. Thanks, Doug. I know you're engaged in that. Rick is. Are you standing, Patty? That's a joke, sorry. So hurtful, right? Yeah. Wow. I'm going to pay for that later. I just know it. I know it. Okay. Greeters. If you're on a greeters team, if you're someone who's at the door, as people come in, you're like, hey, welcome. Glad you're here. All right. Our kids zone staffs. Most of them are out there right now. Are there any kids zone staff in here right now? If you are, please stand. Okay. Our youth staff. Are there any youth staff, any youth workers here? There's one there, and I think there's a couple others that are in Mexico or otherwise away this morning. And then again, our setup crews who take it all back and put it back into the container. So would you join me in, our worship leaders, if you are involved in leading worship at all, how could I forget that? So singing, playing, and somehow otherwise connected to it. Perfect, keep going, good. Okay, so look around. These are the people we wanted to say thank you so much this morning for. So would you join me in doing that? Thank you. And you can be seated now. Takes a village. Okay. Over some time now, we've been talking about sharing our testimonies, and we've been describing that, subtitled that, the stories we tell, and we act out about our faith in God. We talked about testimony as being how ordinary Christians talk about God and faith when we are in church and when we aren't in church. And about being mindful of who we are talking to and what they need to hear. And about living lives that are congruent with the things that we say. Most recently, we talked about why we share our stories of faith, particularly with each other. And here are the reasons in summary. So here we go. The first one is because testimony is just telling the truth. Good thing to do. Second, because testimony instructs the community. Third, because testimony strengthens people for the struggle. Fourthly, because testimony brings healing. And then lastly, because testimony helps us remember that God is in charge. So think on those things for a second, right? This is why we share stories. When we share stories, we're dead. Shared stories. Stories are evidence of change. Things that don't change aren't growing. Things that aren't growing are dead. Share the stories. This morning, though, we're going to talk about where and how we might share our testimonies with people who don't share our faith. Let's begin here. The Bible says, and this is the first of the next slide, please. We, you and me, are Christ's ambassadors as though God were making his appeal through us. So tell me your thoughts. What do you think an ambassador is, and what do you think his or her function is? So your thoughts. An ambassador. Just blurt it out. What? Represent. Yep. Okay. Appointed. So if someone is appointed, is a representative of what? What? Of God? In this case, in our context, correct. in general. It's an ambassador is someone who is appointed by representative of a country, actually, a political state. Well, we aren't, because God's kingdom is not political, it's not geographical, it is spiritual. This is the dictionary definition. An accredited, so appointed, diplomat sent by a country as its official representative to a foreign country. In other words, if we're to apply it to our context and this verse, we are God's children of, by faith, men, women, students, sent by him into a world of foreigners to faith to represent his kingdom of love and forgiveness as official representatives of his kingdom, making God's appeal to these folks who don't know him. So what's God's appeal? Maybe you can tell me a little bit about that too. What do you think is God's appeal to man? Yeah. Oh, I raised the hand. That was beautiful. Thank you. Is that Pentecostal? What was that? Okay. Teacher. To know him. Okay. His power. Okay. God's appeal to us. Through us to others. Love one another, sir. I would suggest, and those are all great answers, by the way. It's been the same forever. It's the same appeal that the prophet Isaiah made, actually, on behalf of God way back in the day. And it's found in Isaiah chapter 45, verse 22. If you want to turn your Bibles there, or you can read it here. I think through Isaiah, through us as ambassadors, we are inviting people to turn to God and be saved. All you ends of the earth, for I am God and there is no other. See, God is saying, and has been saying from the beginning, you will die without me. I am love. I'm not loving. God says, I am love. Right? And that love is your source for life. In this life and in the life yet to come. As if God was saying this again, interpreting this a little bit. I did not want the separation between us that you brought upon yourselves, children. Which the Bible describes as sin. I've bridged the gap between us, though, that sin creates through my Son. Turn to me. And be saved. I am the way. The only way. But at least we've got a way back. This is our message as ambassadors of God. Our King. And heaven, his country. To share with people who Jesus describes as harassed and helpless, like sheep without a shepherd. How do we enter this world and communicate God's appeal to turn people towards him, towards love and forgiveness? Well, Simon Peter has an answer. I think that's really helpful. In your hearts, this is 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, set apart Christ as Lord and always be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you to give you the reason for the hope that you have in you. But do this with gentleness and respect. You see now, Isander, your story makes sense. In your heart, set apart Christ as Lord. So, okay, so don't set apart Christ like something you'll use later, or like a keepsake that you don't want broken, or like that crazy 80s trend of setting aside an entire living room with furniture covered with plastic. Like, don't set him aside that way. Do you remember that? Oh, my God. We had that in our home. Can we go in that room? No, don't go in that room. But there's plastic on the front. That's what, no. Okay. Not like that, set apart. Set Christ apart from everything else. Money, popularity, adventure, video games, your collection of Smurf characters, like whatever. Set Christ apart as your one and only, as your first and principal love, as the one you let define you, who you are. Your love is who I am. As the one who guides you in every decision you make. Let your relationship with Jesus Christ be the filter through which you see yourself, you see others, and you see your stuff. When we do this, we will see ourselves as loved and forgiven, which very often I don't. And it's a constant battle. So if you think because I'm talking to you, I have this all figured out, I always feel loved, I feel confident in Christ all the time, 24/7, this just isn't true. It's as much a battle for me as it is for you. But tell yourself the truth. And the truth is you are loved enough that someone would die. No, the God of the universe would die for you. If you see your life as filtered through the lens of Jesus Christ, we'll see others as worthy of love and forgiveness, as image bearers, as holy dear to God. And we will see our treasures of this earth, our stuff, as this, where moths eat them and rust destroys them and where thieves break in and steal them. We're not taking them with us anyway. It's just stuff. Let me ask you. This is the key question for the morning. If I had to identify one, it'd be this. What fascinates you about Jesus Christ? And I'm asking that because I think we actually set apart what fascinates us. So, what fascinates you about Jesus Christ? You can answer if you want, but I am going to answer it for me. Because if you don't find Jesus Christ fascinating, then I'm not sure you've met him. You will be gobsmacked, as the Brits might say, to learn how this guy rolls, what he does, that he's still alive, even though they killed him. He will not be put down. No. I'm fascinated. I'll tell you two things I'm fascinated by, and then I'm going to tell you a bunch of stories. Because I think if we can spend a little time just going, that is fascinating about Jesus. That is so, that's pretty good time spent, particularly at church. So, I'm fascinated by Jesus, his cool, his collectedness, and his thoughtfulness, like consistently when he was under pressure, right? So a couple examples. Jesus was teaching, the chief priests and the elders of the people, the religious leaders of the day came to him and questioned him about his authority. Like, whose authority are you doing all these things? Like, what name? Like, whose name? Like, what's going on? Where are you? He answered their question with, oh yes, you know it, a question. Okay, so John's baptism, where did it come from? Was it from heaven or was it from men? If you can answer that question, I'll tell you who gave me my authority. So they're trying to trap him, as per usual. Their vestiges of authority are being threatened by a guy who doesn't seek it. He just has it. So they talked about it amongst themselves and reasoned, okay, if we see from heaven, then he'll say, well, why didn't you believe in him then? If we see from men, then the people will, well, they'll lynch us because they thought John was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, and you know the answer if you've read the story. We don't know. We just don't know. Then he said, then I can't tell you by what authority I'm doing these things either, because we would interpret, they wouldn't know what to do with his answer anyway. And more than likely, they would dismiss it and not know. Another occasion. The chief priests and the teachers of the law, wow, there you go, there's a theme here, sent spies to catch Jesus in something he might say that they could use against him later. So first, the spies, they buttered him up. Teacher, they said, we know you speak and teach what is right, and that you do not show partiality, but you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. And I say, I don't suspect Jesus was going, thank you, that is so true. I suspect he was like, I think I know what's underneath that, actually. Then they ask this question, is it right for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Well, Jesus knows that if he says yes, then his fellow Jews would be pretty miffed because they hated paying taxes to Rome. Why is that? because who likes paying taxes? No, particularly them, because they were not Roman citizens. But if he says, no, don't pay the tax, then he might be in a little bit of trouble with Roman Revenue Agency, right? He was in a pickle, to be sure. He said to them, okay, well, show me the coin. Taking the coin, examining it like a prop for an object lesson, he said to them, whose picture's on it? Caesar's? They replied, probably a little bit stunned that he had to even ask the question. And he said to them, then give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. So stunned and awkward silence followed. If someone would have asked Jesus at that time about that last line, they would have asked him, so what is God's? He likely would have answered, as compared to where Caesar's image is, where does God's image lie? An answer every good Israelite would have known for sure, hands down, because they can quote the first five books. They would have said, well, God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. Which is to say, give to God what is God's. In other words, you owe him yourself because you bear his image. The coin bears Caesar's. You bear God's. Give him you, all of you. Give Caesar the coin. Right? On yet another occasion, still they're trying to squeeze him, trying to pop him, trying to get him in trouble. Their religious leaders brought a woman to him. This is one of my favorite stories of Scripture, which I think I've said before, who they caught in the act of adultery. Jewish law at that time actually required that the woman and the man be executed. They sort of, they doctored the law a bit in telling Jesus what needed to be done by saying she needed to be stoned. Didn't have to be certain rules around that. And certainly, it should never have been the case where they brought the woman only. It should have been the woman and the man. Cool and thoughtful Jesus, though. Man alive, this guy fascinates me. No fluster. Dialed into his father. He bends down. He starts to write something on the ground, which we've all tried to interpret at different times. There's reasonable answers to it, but we won't bother going there this morning. No doubt the religious leaders looked at each other as if to say, still here. Why are you writing it? Did you hear our question? I mean, I don't know. Did you hear that? Here again, Jesus knows that if he says yes to stoning the woman, that he'd be in big trouble with the local authorities because Rome would not have allowed Jews, Israelites, to kill each other. Capital punishment was only for the Romans to do. And if he says no, don't stone her, then he would have been accused as not being supportive of the very Jewish law that he taught as a Jewish rabbi. Right? So they got him, right? Well, they continued to question him until he straightened up and he said to them, if any of you is without sin, let him be the first to throw a stone at her. And then he stooped down and wrote on the ground again. Everyone, as you know, if you've read the story, dropped their stones and walked away. The older ones first. And there's something to say there, too, which we've talked about before. Jesus turned to the woman and told her that he wouldn't condemn her either, though he could have. And only him. But encouraged her to leave her life of sin. So I'm fascinated by his cool and thoughtfulness. I think I'm probably fascinated by it because I'm not always cool and thoughtful. I can be emotional and blurting. I'm all over that. Cool and thoughtful is not my go-to. God's working on me. Second thing that just fascinates me about Jesus Christ is his inclusiveness. In an age when children were meant to be seen and not heard, so goes the expression, but it was apt then, Jesus welcomed them, placed his hands on them, and he prayed for them, explaining to the disciples who were trying to keep these children from getting to him that the kingdom of God actually belongs to such as these. What? What? We've been following you for like 3 years now. The kids don't know nothing. I mean, what is that? Inclusive In an age when women were treated as not much more than chattel, Jesus befriended them. He included them amongst his followers, his close disciples, and he cared for them, especially, if you'll remember with me, his mother, who, even when he was dying on the cross, looks down to his mother and his best friend, John. He says, John, would you take care of my mom when I'm gone? In an age when only the male, academic elite, the cream of the crop, were able to apply to sit under the teaching of a rabbi, Jesus called them. And them weren't the most educated. Them were fishermen and tax collectors and political zealots. Not that any of these guys aren't bright. It was totally countercultural at the time. Rabbis don't ask students. Students ask rabbis. And only those students that were absolutely killing it in terms of remembering scripture and applying it and interpreting it correctly. He made time for, he befriended, he taught, he healed men and women and children, Jew, Samaritan, and Gentile alike. He even loved his enemies. So when he tells us to love our enemies, he speaks from experience, right? Think about the religious leaders whom he confronted with the truth. Like, you don't confront people with the truth if you don't care about them. You know, you don't say, hey, be careful of that edge you might step over and plummet to your death if you don't care about the person. Think about those same leaders, religious leaders, who on one occasion blindfolded him, slapped him several times before he was crucified, saying to him, hey, prophesy. Who hit you? Love them. Think about that scene at the cross when Jesus cried out to the Father, forgive them. And by them, it isn't just them. It's all of those that got him there. It's all of us who would put him there otherwise. And we all would. They don't know what they're doing. Jesus was inclusive to the very end. In your hearts, set him aside as Lord. Be fascinated by him. I think being fascinated with Jesus, A, will lead us to easily talk about him, because we talk easily about the things that fascinate us, even when they aren't very good, like the Canucks. And B, have such an impact on our thinking and our behavior that people might even ask us about him watching our lives. And that because we are so fascinated with him, we will be ready to explain the source of our hope. And then we would do that with gentleness and respect, is what the text says. So let's move on. Where do we share our testimonies of hope? Where? Well, there's three places, more or less. We welcome people into our spaces. We enter into other people's spaces when we're welcomed into them, and we meet in neutral spaces. One of the spaces where we share testimony is on our own turf, isn't it? We can welcome people to our spaces. It's easy, actually. We're pretty good at this. Here we offer hospitality to family. We listen to one another. We give time to one another. We support one another. We share a common space. Here, we can also extend the hospitality of a host. We invite others into our homes, into our lives, and into our church, faith community. On that note, by the way, that last one, how are we doing when newcomers join us on a Sunday morning? Remember, newcomers are joining us in our space, where we are comfortable and know each other, and where we control the environment mostly, except for the HVAC, which is never really working in our favor. Churches can be strange environments even when we meet in schools. Do we help newcomers find their way to Kids Zone and youth and worship and the coffee? Do we leave them to safely linger on their own apart from us, detached from everything else at the library that we have over here to my right, your left? Are they the ones sitting alone in the gym at 10:30 because they don't have the good sense to know that we don't really start at 10:30 even though we say 10:30. Because our start times are a wee bit flexible. Do we sit with our friends? Or do we sit with newcomers and our friends? I must say, and I'm asking these questions, I'm not interested in managing brokering guilt, right? That's just so useless. Just take the questions and ask yourselves, what do I do to make those in my space feel welcome here? I gotta tell you, I was proud and I was moved by Ali, if we could say it in the Southern American way, at our recent baptism service. You may remember this. When even before Corey invited you forward in support of his friend Shirley, whom we've never met before, who's never been here before, you guys launched out of your chairs. You came forward. You stood with her. Many of you hugged her and then prayed for her. That is the kind of welcome we want for people who would dare to be amongst us. Because it's new to them. They are newcomers. This said, my friends, I lay down this challenge, which I'll have an image of very shortly. Nope. Nope. Shake the hand of someone you don't know every time we meet for worship together. Every time. Go find someone you don't know. Or someone you know less than someone else. Right? Introduce yourself and find out one fun fact about that person. In a year, I want you to be able to have 50 fun facts floating around. And maybe because you're 50 like me, you'll remember 5 of them. That's okay. That's better than zero. Right? Right. Okay. So that's the challenge. Take it on. I don't even know where I am in my notes anymore. There we go. And this challenge, by the way, I know is like a kind of slow mental, emotional torture for our introverts. I get it. So the introverts are going, ain't no way I'm doing that. Not going to happen. Fair enough. Okay, that's fine. We get it. We're not trying to make you something you're not. We're just going to ask your permission to come your way. Us extroverts. We'll see you at your chair. Another space where we might share our testimonies of hope is in someone else's turf. Wherever that might be. To receive their hospitality. To go where we aren't in control. To be where we might feel a little bit uncomfortable. To go into their homes. To be a part of their lives. To show up to something that is important to them. But there is another space where you might tell our stories of faith. It's not my space. It's not your space. It's not their space. It's an in-between space, what one writer calls liminal space. What I would probably call just simply a third space. Liminal spaces are common spaces, like these, like common activities, like sports, or clubs, or hiking, or biking, or fishing. Common causes, like Cyrus Center, like Ruth and Naomi's mission. Common hangouts, like our neighborhoods, like the parks in our neighborhoods, like the laneway that I live on. Perhaps the clearest visual for this third space type is simply Starbucks. It's not mine, it's not yours. It's this cool, aromatic, semi-boisterous third space where you can sit and listen to music while you have your coffee or eat your oat fudge bar or both. Or where you can put your feet up and read a book or study for exams or work on your origami in a crowd so you don't feel so lonely. Or where you can meet people to talk about life and limb and maybe even share a testimony of hope with them. Ah! But what do you say in these spaces, once you get there? That's the cracker, isn't it? In short, we should listen first, answer second, explain something, maybe, and maybe share a story. Our hospital chaplain, Jim Gates, is an awesome example of a guy who knows how to enter liminal space and how to listen and answer questions and share hope. His summer newsletter that he sends out quarterly is, not summer, but quarterly, is on our info table. I'm going to read a short story from that newsletter, but I encourage you to get it if you'd like to, and just take one home. We can make more. One morning, and now this is Jim speaking, I arrived at a new patient's bed with my usual greeting. Hi, I'm Jim, and I'm the chaplain. I'm just dropping by to make sure that you're not worried or scared. The patient immediately responded by saying, I'm really worried and I'm really scared. She went on to share that she was new to Chilliwack and hadn't had a chance to make any new friends. She had lost over 60 pounds, and they couldn't figure out why she kept losing weight. Her weight had dropped to barely 100 pounds, and she couldn't afford to lose any more. She was experiencing seizures on a daily basis, and it was scary for her not to know where she would wake up next. I talked with her for a while and then asked if she would be okay if I said a prayer for her. She said, I don't go to church, but please do. I prayed, and then as I was leaving, she said that she already felt more peaceful. Several days later, I came to her room, and she was sitting on her bed and was very frustrated and angry. She said that they didn't have any answers yet. She was tired of waiting, that the staff didn't know what they said they were going to do, and they didn't do what they were saying to do, and that no one cared about her. She had made up her mind that she wasn't waiting any longer and that she was checking herself out right away. I sat down with her and told her that people did care, and certainly Jim would be the evidence of that. I tried to calm her and encourage her not to leave. I again asked her if I could pray for her, and she again agreed. She promised to wait a few more hours for at least that time for a test that she said was supposed to happen the day before and that she was sure wasn't going to happen today. The next day, she was all smiles when I saw her in the hall, and she ran up to me and gave me a big hug, and I'm quoting this woman now, God answered your prayers. They came and gave me the test and told me that I don't have cancer, and I've already gained 2 pounds. Now I get to go home and just be an outpatient. Thank you for your prayers. As I thought about this morning, actually coming in, another good example of going into third spaces, not mine, not yours, would be what our missions team is doing right now. Actually, that's not a good example. That's a good example of what I'm going to say next. Let's go there. Here's one story that relates to that second space going into. One of my favorite pastor, this is a good one for the youth, actually. One of my favorite pastor, teacher, author, communicators remains Canadian-born Bruxy Cavey at the Meeting House in Oakville. He provides a really good example of someone who's able and ready to share hope in someone else's space. Some time ago, Bruxy got a tattoo on the inside of his left forearm, right about there. The tattoo was the address of a Bible verse. Having some sense of this, his tattoo artist asked him about it. She said, you know, I'll bite. What's the verse say? So he told her, quoting Leviticus chapter 19, verse 28, do not cut your bodies for the dead and do not mark your skin with tattoos. I am the Lord. That's why I like him, right? Okay, she said, now I've got to ask, why are you getting the tattoo then? But he set it up perfectly, right? This was his goal. He then went on to explain that life with God isn't about rules, regulations, rituals, routines. It is simply about a relationship with Jesus Christ. Period. Tattoo evangelism. Like, okay, so just to, as a disclaimer, this is not suggesting you should all go and get tattoos, or that it should be Leviticus, because you got to be ready for this. You got to be prepared. You got to be fascinated by. Because if you're having this there, they're going to ask you. All right, we're almost done. And then there's those times when people might come our way, visit with us, in our homes, in our spaces. What are we going to say then? Again, we need to listen, to know them, to understand them, to answer any questions that we might be able to answer, those that they ask, and maybe those that they're not asking, but you know are sitting right there. They're latent. We explain why we think and do and say some things and not others. And we talk about what fascinates us about Christ and how we get through life with a kind of joy. If we think that sharing those kinds of stories might be helpful at that time, hopeful at that time, listening for the Spirit of God to prompt us towards that. Should I share that story? And maybe you don't share it all because you have a sense as you're sharing it, they're not ready, like whatever that looks like, right? It's a dance. It's a very intuitive, organic thing. So you might say, in your home, with those people coming your way, like, can I pray for you? And can I? And then, you know, pray for them right there. Or even on the phone, you're in that space together. That's more like liminal space. But anyway, like, I'm so sorry that happened to you. Good listening. That must have been devastating. How did that make you feel? And then could I maybe share with you something that's been helpful for me when things like this have happened to me before? I'm not ready for that right now. No, thanks. Fair enough. And I'm just going to sit with you. Like, you know, what amazes me about Jesus? And then go on to explain that. What amazes me about Jesus is how cool and thoughtful he is under pressure. I'm trying to be like that. I don't want to be not like that. Like, I read, I heard, I saw something recently that might be helpful. Can I share that with you? And then read to them that article or that highlighted piece of text. Or share that song with them, or that soundbite of something else, or show them that YouTube video, or send them that Vimeo link to that particular piece. We'll end there, but in this spirit of being amongst here, in this space, which is sort of like our space, I'd like to close with two stories, actually, two poems. One from my daughter, Kaylee, whose permission I got to read this morning to you as a 15-year-old veteran middle school kid to us and to other kids her age and those slightly older. And then another poem from our residential writer and child care professional, Anne Herridge. So, Anne, if you want to come up now, I'll get you to do that. You can maybe even grab a mic. I'll just read this poem from Kaylee, which is kind of short, and then I think, well, you can choose one or the other. I'm not sure what we decided, but yeah, I'm glad. I was hoping you'd say that. Good. That's the one I was hoping. So, this is for my daughter, and it's called Gossip. Probably something alien for middle school students or adults. How harsh can one word be, ripping and tearing one's image? How deceptive one lie can be, leading you to believe it's true. How cruel our heart can be, wanting to believe the lie and see failure. How tempting information can be, like a virus wanting to spread. How strange our mind can be, knowing the consequences. How heartless one can be when they still follow through with hurting those they love.
I want to say that your sermon was doubly good today. Oh, it was.
That's great. I don't even.
Twice as good as normal.
Because I asked for it, I don't even know it's true, but because you said it, I know it's true, so that's good. Thanks, Anne.
This poem is called Forgiven, and I wrote it a few years ago when I. You know how sometimes you're just aware of how short we fall of God's standards, yeah. And so I was kind of feeling that, and then it's his reply. How dark a place I find I'm in, because I fail, because of sin. The consequences now I bear of words and deeds spent without care. How can my master look at me, he who the depths of my heart sees? How dark my soul can be at times, how far from his divine design. Then comes a whisper in the gloom, a gentle voice that fills my room. I already knew your sin, my child. I saw what Satan would defile. I saw this day before your birth and all your days upon the earth. And still I chose to bless your name because it was for you I came. I see the end result in sight. I see your life now clothed in light. I trust you more than you can know, for on you grace I have bestowed. My work in you has just begun. My plan for you is not yet done. I know the places where you'll fall, the places where there are great walls. I see your heart from inside out. I know your struggles and your doubts. I know the days when you will fail, yet naught but grace and love prevail. Don't fret, my child, when you are weak. Come, run to me and hear me speak. And speak to me, don't hide your soul. Let me heal and make you whole. Take my hand, come walk with me. I'll guide your path when you can't see. Know that all I have for you is grace and trust that you'll come through. For long ago at Calvary, I died for you to make you free. I took the scorn and pain and blame, so you, my child, should not feel shame. My death back then was for all time, past, present, future, so you are mine. Your sins are covered by my blood. I paid the price. You're free, my love. So come, my child, look at my face. No disappointment or disgrace. No condemnation here you'll find, just love, acceptance in my eyes. Come, lift your face, now look at me, for grace and pride are all you'll see, as I perfect your true design, because, dear child, you are mine.